You hear about a ladder of development from many commentators on development, many policymakers in development. The idea here is there's different rungs of the ladder, and more developed, more capable countries sit at higher rungs. And what rung you are kind of determines the set of economic activities you can perform. And as countries develop and move up this ladder, and you're able to produce more complex goods. What we're trying to understand is this metaphor valid, and is it useful for thinking about this process of trade and development? Is trade able to push you up the ladder?
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. We can think of development as a ladder. It is a useful metaphor, but is it true? Can every country climb it? David Atkin of MIT and his co-authors have used this idea as a starting point to investigate the interaction between global trade and development. And he joins me now to tell me what they discovered. David, welcome to Vox Dev Talks. Welcome back to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here.
If we're talking about the interaction between trade and climbing this ladder of development, which way round are we thinking this works? Do countries that grow economically trade more complex goods, or is it that countries that start to trade complex goods then grow economically?
That's an excellent question, excellent starting point. So, you know, our goal in this paper was to try and think about both those forces and, you know, try and disentangle them and think about how important they are. So obviously, in the first case, we think that, you know, if a country becomes more economically capable, then it's naturally going to kind of shift the type of products that it produces and therefore export what we think of as kind of more complex goods. But at the same time, there may also be a mechanism going in the other direction through which actually trade affects the development process rather than development affecting the goods you trade. And that is, trade may shift the type of goods you make because, for example, prices are different elsewhere in the world, which is kind of pushing you into producing product A, not product B. And if it does so, and it pushes you into certain types of what we might call good products, then those good products may have greater opportunities for learning or higher spillovers. And that could actually lead to greater economic growth subsequently. And so in that way, trade, for example, the entry of China into the global trading system or the formation of the WTO by changing what you're producing may actually make you produce different things. And those different things may make you grow faster.
Explain to me a little bit more. What might be the policy implication if this first idea that economic growth means you start to trade more complex goods, if that was more important?
That's a kind of very kind of standard force. You'll get that in any model of trade where if I become more capable, and if we think of economic growth as making you more capable, then I'll start kind of shifting my comparative advantage into producing goods that require this extra capability. And we might call those kind of more complex goods. And there, you know, from a policy perspective, there isn't many ramifications. This is efficient. The government shouldn't really be intervening. The fact that they're producing widget A, which is complex, rather than widget B, which isn't, doesn't make any difference for welfare. And we should let the guiding hand of market forces determine what's being produced. So if instead what's important is this link from trade to development, whereby forces in other countries, for example, lead you to produce a different bundle of goods, and that different bundle of goods leads you to grow faster, then we're in the classic case where there are externalities. What the market determines is not necessarily going to be efficient. There's room for government intervention. In particular, if there are these good sectors, you typically want to be promoting those good sectors in order to kind of move more resources into them and grow faster. And so for policy questions, it's pretty important to understand whether or not there is this second force. There are these good sectors and bad sectors.
We're talking about good sectors and bad sectors. What precisely do we mean by that?
Another excellent question. So there are obviously many ways we can think about this. In the context of our paper, what we think about is a kind of good sector is one which has high spillovers, high externalities, by which we mean there's maybe greater scope for learning, or the learning you do kind of spills over more readily to other industries. And in particular, the idea we have in mind here is that good sectors are these more complex sectors, the ones on your frontier, where You know, you're learning lots more when you're producing the most complex things you can than you're producing much simpler things that you've maybe been producing for hundreds of years already. And so this matches quite well with much of the industrial policy discussion, where you kind of want to go into modern manufacturing sectors where there's a lot of learning, and those are your frontier sectors. So we think of these good sectors as the ones that are relatively complex compared to the other things that you produce.
And if we're thinking about this as part of a ladder of development, my mental model of a ladder is that everybody can climb up it. Thinking about these explanations for growth and trade, does that mean that everyone can climb up it? Or is it a sort of zero-sum game that if some people climb up, others are left at the bottom?
You hear about a ladder of development from many commentators on development, many policymakers in development, people such as Ricardo Hausmann, Justin Lin, for example, Hajun Chang. And you know, the idea here is there's different rungs of the ladder, and more developed, more capable countries sit at higher rungs. And what rung you are kind of determines the set of economic activities you can perform. And as countries develop and move up this ladder, and you're able to produce more complex goods. What we're trying to understand is this metaphor valid, and is it useful for thinking about this process of trade and development? Is trade able to push you up the ladder? And the classic literature on this in trade and development has these good and bad products like we are talking about here. Mm-hmm. And there you do have this zero-sum result. So if you start trading with another country, then either you have a comparative advantage in a good product or a bad product. If you had a comparative advantage in the good product, you're going to make more of that, and that's going to be good. And meanwhile, if you had a comparative advantage in the bad product, that's going to be bad. And one country necessarily is going to be pushed up, and one country is going to be pushed down in that respect. Where we depart from that is we're thinking about a world where there's many countries and many products. And in addition, we're kind of thinking a little technical tweak here is we're thinking about this kind of ladder as mainly a process that works on what we call the extensive margin, i.e. whether or not you're able to produce a particular product or not, rather than how relatively good you are at producing it. Why do we come at it from that way? Well, a lot of this very influential work that the listeners may be familiar with by Ricardo Hausmann and co-authors is thinking about countries are able to make aircraft when they become more complex, and when they're capable, and when they're less capable, they're not able to make aircraft. And so that's kind of our jumping off point. And in that world, what we show is that, as you've mentioned in the beginning, all countries are able to move up the ladder as a result of starting to trade. And the intuition for that is actually quite simple. So let's start with a country like the United States. So they're a very, very capable country. They're able to produce very complex things. And if they start trading with the rest of the world, they're going to have a comparative advantage at the kind of most complex goods, because they're the only ones who are able to produce these most sophisticated goods. Mm-hmm. And so what trade is going to do is it's going to push their resources, their labor, for example, relatively into their more complex goods that no one else is able to do, and there's no competition. And it's going to push them out of their least complex goods like t-shirts or underwear that everyone in the world's able to produce and they can bring in from other countries. And so there you can see how it's shifting labor into more complex sectors. And if there are gains in terms of growth from producing in these more complex sectors where there's a lot to learn, then you're going to see faster growth. But that same logic is actually true for a country much further down the ladder. So think about Bangladesh, for example. So they're not the poorest country in the world, but they're much less wealthy than the United States. While it's true that they can't produce, you know, jet engines or microchips, it's still going to be the case that the most complex goods that they can produce are going to have much less competition than the least complex goods that they produce, because everyone in the world is able to produce the least complex goods, while only half the countries in the world are able to produce the most complex goods. So it's still the case that relatively, you're going to be shifting labor into your more complex goods and you're going to grow faster. This is quite a powerful result, that trade has the ability to push everyone up the ladder. Of course, there are other type of counterfactuals you might want to think about. And an obvious one would be, you know, what happens if you're already trading, which is maybe a more realistic setting, and then a country like China enters the world trading system. So there, very much, some countries will be pushed up and some countries will be pushed down. If you happen to be competing a lot with China in your most complex goods, you'll be pushed out of them into your less complex goods. That will reduce your growth rate. Meanwhile, if China happens to be competing in your least complex goods, think of a country like Italy or something like that, then maybe you're pushed into more complex sectors and you grow faster. And so there you can very much get some countries being pushed up and some countries being pushed down, even in a very stylized version of this model.
So we're thinking about China as a sort of a balloon in the middle, are we? Squeezing up and squeezing down.
Yes, that's a nice way to think about it. It's pushing more capable countries to produce their most complex goods and pushing less capable to produce their least complex goods by coming in the middle there and competing in those intermediate goods. Part of our motivation for writing this whole paper is this idea you often hear about that, you know, nowadays it's much harder to climb this ladder because China's there sitting in the middle. And, you know, a country like Bangladesh in generations past might have had a trajectory more similar to South Korea's, where they quickly marched into more complex goods. And here they're kind of being blocked by China. And that's something we pursue at the end of this paper and actually surprisingly find that's not really the story for Bangladesh, but maybe is for Africa.
You're modeling complexity of goods and capability of countries to create those goods. But to test your model empirically, you have to be able to measure these things. First of all, measuring complexity in goods. How do you do this? What sort of data allows you to do that?
I guess in my mind, there's a couple of things we do in this paper. One is what we've just been talking about, which is this theoretical result, which helps us kind of understand potentially the impacts of trade on development. As well, there's two sets of empirical findings, which I think are very useful both for researchers and policymakers. And the first is this measurement question of how do we define countries as capable and countries as complex? Your listeners may be familiar, again, with this large body of work pioneered by Ricardo Hausmann and others, which use various methods to come up with product complexity indexes and economic capability indexes for different countries. Those methods are a little bit separated from mainstream economics in the sense that they rely on some methods borrowed from the physics literature. One of our goals of this paper is to try and form a bridge with that literature by coming up with measures that behave in actually quite similar ways to those existing measures, but kind of have a micro foundation with classical economic production functions. And the way we do that, we start with kind of a simple assumption, which is that countries are more capable if they produce more complex goods, and more complex goods are produced by more capable countries. And essentially writing that down, this written down simply as kind of a complementarity in the production function where a more capable country has higher productivity at producing a more complex good and vice versa. Mm-hmm. You can start with a guess. You say, hey, I think that the US is very capable. That's going to tell you what goods are complex. Those are the ones that they're relatively good at producing. And then once I know which goods are complex, then I can tell you which countries are capable. Those are the countries that are relatively good at producing them. And I can keep on iterating that until I get to a fixed point. And then we'll get a ranking of all the countries in terms of their capability and all the goods in terms of their complexity. And in order to do this with a rich data set, we follow this work of Hausmann and others in using the export data, which goes back many, many years and is collected in a consistent way across countries using product codes that can be tracked from the 1960s to the present. And we have kind of very detailed products. And really, that's the only game in town if you want many countries, many years, many products, since there's not really any straightforward way to concord hundreds of countries' different industrial statistics, which often just are almost impossible to obtain in many cases. We think about what do people produce based on what they export, and then we're looking out some kind of productivity at producing these from these export patterns with this complementary assumption underneath it to back out what is a capable country and what is a complex good.
You can make at any point in time a ranking then, David, on capability for countries based on their ability to produce these complex goods. But then you're looking at the changes in this, aren't you? So how do we produce some sort of causal interpretation of what is changing what over time?
So once we've got these type of measures, and reassuringly, they look reasonable. You know, the US is very capable. South Korea wasn't initially very capable, catches up. Many African countries have remained not very capable. And the types of goods you might think of are complex, are complex. We want to try and see whether or not there is some evidence for this idea that if I shift into producing more complex goods, does my capability grow faster? So this is the key dynamic mechanism that is at the center of those theoretical results I was talking about earlier, which is if trade shifts you into these sectors, you grow faster because producing in those sectors makes you grow faster. So in order to try and ascertain whether or not there's truth in that particular assumption we have, what we're going to do is we kind of want some kind of shifter which makes a country, for reasons unrelated to their domestic policies, start producing more complex goods and see whether or not their capability grows faster subsequently. Mm-hmm. And the kind of way we're going to do that is with an instrumental variable strategy, where we're going to basically use the entry of other countries in the world into the World Trade Organization. And so think about China. They entered the World Trade Organization in the early 2000s. And when they entered, essentially what that was a kind of massive reduction in their trade costs with many other countries. And if I'm a country, say Italy, which is mainly competing in third markets with China in very complex goods, versus a country such as Bangladesh that's mainly competing for textiles or less complex goods, then it's going to have a kind of different impact on the complexity of the products you produce. So in one case, they may be competing with your most complex products, which would be Bangladesh's case, or they're competing with your least complex products, which would be Italy's case. And there we'd expect to see potentially Italy being pushed up in capability mm-hmm. and Bangladesh being pushed down, as we talked about earlier. What we're going to do is calculate the relative complexity of the competition coming from these new WTO entrants and use that as a kind of an instrument. And indeed, it's true, you start producing more complex goods based on those rankings we've recovered earlier when countries enter the WTO that are competing with you in third markets in your relatively complex goods compared to when they're competing with you in your relatively non-complex goods. And so that's the basic idea. And indeed, we find that your capability does grow faster when you're kind of pushed into producing these more complex goods by the entry of other countries into the World Trade Organization. So that's some support for this key assumption, this key mechanism whereby what you produce affects your growth rate.
Now, however, your model does hold out the tantalizing possibility that every country can climb the ladder. Do your empirical results support the idea that this is happening? It sounds not.
You have indeed read the paper. It should, you know, a bit of background here. So we have this theoretical result that every country can climb up. Mm. At the center of it is this idea that you get shifted into more complex goods by trade, and those make you grow faster. The question that we were unsure about was whether or not indeed being shifted into more complex goods made you grow faster. So that's where we focused the empirics on. And then we kind of just assumed it must therefore be true that every country was going to gain from trade. But yeah, when we actually crunched the numbers and tried to quantify this, almost every country was predicted to lose from this dynamic mechanism. There are also static yeah. gains from trade, which are positive. But from this dynamic mechanism, from this externalities, every country is predicted to lose. And at first, I'll be honest with you, we thought we'd messed up the quantification and our model was wrong because we were so sure that every country was meant to gain given our kind of more simplified model. But in the end, it turned out that there's really this crucial second assumption, which we just assumed was true, which is that when you open to trade, fewer countries are producing the most complex goods yeah. and more countries are producing the least complex. And so you're naturally being pushed out of the sectors that many countries produce, like underwear, and pushed into sectors which few countries produce, like aircraft or medicines or something like that, if you're able to produce those goods. Mm-hmm. What we found in the data is actually the opposite is true. So to give an example, almost every country in the world exports medicines. Mm-hmm. And medicines come out as a very complex good. Why? Because relatively more capable countries are able to produce in medicines. So Switzerland, Japan, the US are massive exporters of medications. But it turns out that almost every country is producing them and exporting them. Meanwhile, you take a good like men's underwear, which is quite simple to produce. Well, it turns out actually very few countries export men's underwear. And those that do, I mean, that market is incredibly dominated by China, as you might guess. And so it means that if you go from autarky, where there's no trade, to a trading economy, even a country like the US is being pushed out of medicines and being pushed in to underwear through the forces of trade, since they're facing a lot of competition from other countries in medicines, but they're not facing a lot of competition in underwear. That's actually leading you to move into these bad sectors, these ones with low spillovers. And that's why there's kind of pervasive dynamic losses from trade, as we call it. That on average, most countries are losing out through this dynamic mechanism from trade. And, you know, this is a very surprising finding. I was very surprised by it. And so, you know, one thing you might think is that this is just an artifact of this way that we're telling you what is good is capable and what good is complex. Mm. And so in the paper, we flip the whole exercise. And rather than defining a good as complex if capable countries produce it, instead, we define a good as complex if very few countries produce it. And so there we're really mapping it directly to how much competition are you going to face if you start trading? Well, if very few countries produce it, you won't face much competition. You'll be shifted into that sector.
Mm-hmm.
And when we define things that way, we get very similar definition of which countries are capable. Those are the countries that produce many goods. But the goods that we then also call complex, but it really means that few countries produce, turn out to be a very different list of products. There we start having the things such as the undergarments, which, as I told you, very few countries produce. We get a very, very different list of what goods you might think of as complex under this definition. But those same goods, when we go and rerun these estimates of what happens to capability growth when you get pushed into them, when you move into these sectors, your capability growth goes down.
Mm-hmm.
And so kind of very strong feature of the data is the type of sectors that there aren't many countries producing are the ones which have low spillovers, the ones that don't make you grow. Meanwhile, the products which many countries produce are the ones that are making you grow. That's where this pervasive dynamic losses are coming from. And so either way we run it, whether we define complex goods as the ones that capable countries are relatively better at making, which leads us to a list that looks a lot like a list you might come up with of products that might have high spillovers, like aircraft and electronics. They do indeed have high spillovers, but you're being pushed out of them. Or if you define it in terms of products that few countries produce, then this list looks like a bunch of products that have low spillovers. They do indeed have low spillovers, and you're pushed into these and you grow slower as a result of it. So that was a surprising result. And at the heart of it is this fact in the data. And this is true also using other people's measures, such as the Hausman measures or Roderick Hausman measures, if people are familiar with those, that these kind of products that are quite complex have a lot of countries producing them. There's one policy takeaway. It's understanding that we live in a world where that is true. And that means that there's going to be this force pushing you into those types of sectors, which is kind of pushing you away from the sectors which you might think are good sectors to be producing in.
If we have this slightly depressing result that a ladder is something you can descend as well as climb, in the empirical data, which countries are we seeing as a result of, well, I guess the China shock is the big event in trade in the last couple of decades, are being pushed down?
Excellent opportunity to clarify that all these discussions about everyone being pushed up or pushed down is under this very common hypothetical we perform in academic circles of asking, what if everyone was in autarky?
Mm-hmm.
And then we suddenly open the world to trading with each other.
Yeah.
Okay, and when we talk about gains from trade, we're often thinking about that world. Obviously, for the policymaker, unless you know something really bad has happened and we have whatever some worst case scenario, global war or something, we're all trading with each other a lot already. And then the question is, you know, there's some big shock here, there, whatever, what happens? And there, as you say, these questions about what happens when China enters the world trading system seem more relevant for policy questions.
Mm-hmm.
And so we also think about that in the paper. And there, what we find is these forces, which I already highlighted, which are some countries are pushed up, some countries are pushed down. And as you would expect, the countries that are pushed up are the ones where China's competing in their least complex goods. So we find, you know, countries such as Italy or European nations or South Korea. Meanwhile, countries that are pushed down are African countries, Bangladesh, etc. China is competing in these countries' relatively complex sectors. These may be the same products. You can think of some somewhat sophisticated textile sector as being complex for Bangladesh, but very uncomplex for Sweden or something.
Mm-hmm.
Here, we actually find somewhat nuanced answers, however, which is that we don't find this has been a big deal when thinking about South Asian countries like Bangladesh, where part of the motivation for this paper was understanding why a country like Bangladesh, which has been very successful exporting, hasn't maybe climbed the value chain to the same degree as in previous generations. There, we don't find a lot of action. Where we find actually a lot of actions for African countries, in the absence of China entering the world economy, then they would have become more capable, they would have grown more.
Right.
And the reason why China held back Africa much more than South Asia is kind of threefold. The first is a mechanism I've been highlighting here, that is the sectors that China has a comparative advantage in are indeed relatively complex for Africa. The second reason is that China's also been purchasing a lot of African goods, and in particular, it's been purchasing a lot of Africa's least complex goods. And so there's kind of this push force where they're pushing them out of the more complex, and the pull force where they're purchasing a lot of their least complex goods, which is pulling labor into those sectors. And so that's kind of an additional force. And then, you know, thirdly, and this may be slightly more of an artifact of our model, is these African countries don't produce that many goods. And so small changes in what they're producing can have much larger effects. And so that's partly why the effect of China is kind of larger for them, is there's a possibility of causing larger impacts when you're producing fewer goods. I think the key ones here is, you know, these countries are being pushed out of these sectors, and China's kind of pulling them as well by pulling them into least complex sectors. And I think there's definitely policy ramifications there. And, you know, we should be thinking about ways of counteracting that by potentially supporting these more complex production in these more complex sectors in these African countries in order for them to benefit from the static gains from trade, the, you know, ability to exploit comparative advantage, as well as not lose out from some of these dynamic effects by also being able to manufacture at your frontier where there's kind of bigger gains from learning.
Yes, finally, David, is this a reason to rethink policy and how we think about trade as an engine of development and growth? We might have overestimated the capability of trade to be able to create development in Africa, for example.
I think maybe it's overly strong to say rethink. Obviously, there's been a long history of ideas about promoting good sectors which are close to your frontier. Mm-hmm. And I think we provide some support for those types of ideas are already out there, maybe more so in the policy world than in the academic world. I think what the other big takeaway here is that, you know, these natural forces coming from what other countries are good at relative to what you're good at are kind of pushing in the other direction. Mm-hmm. And so there, while there may be substantial static gains in terms of shifting you into good sectors, we shouldn't necessarily expect trade to be doing that. And then the shocks to trade, such as the entry of China and such like, we need to think about them on a case-to-case basis, but we should be thinking about, are these likely to push you into good sectors or push you into bad sectors based on what are those countries buying and what are they selling? Or if there's some change in policy, I don't know, if you're thinking of joining a free trade agreement, what products are you going to be able to sell more of? What products are people going to buy more of? And also, where are you going to face more competition for your exports, etc.?
David, thank you very much for talking about your paper. It's one of those papers where you read it, you go away and think about it, and then you think, I'm going to have to read that one again. Did it really say that? Thank you very much for explaining it to us.
Thank you very much for having me on the podcast. It was a pleasure to talk to you as always.
The paper is called Globalization and the Ladder of Development, Pushed to the Top or Held at the Bottom. And the authors are David Atkin, you just heard from him, Arno Costino and Masao Fukui. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. Wherever you get your podcasts, you will find us there. And all our past episodes, as ever, are at voxdev.org, where you will find articles about the papers we feature.